When I was an undergraduate in college, I walked the same path to my classes virtually every day. And as I did, I would walk through a gate. And over the gate was an inscription. The inscription said, "Enter and grow in wisdom." For 4 years, I asked myself a question every day as I walked to class. Am I growing in wisdom? And in honesty, I had to say, very little, actually, was I growing in wisdom. In knowledge, yes, as one would expect someone to do in college. In facts, in data, but not necessarily in wisdom. And instinctively, even though I couldn't have given a very good definition of wisdom in those days, I think it was plain to me that wisdom is something more than knowledge. It's not just facts. It's not just data. In fact, perhaps we could begin by saying that wisdom has something to do with the arrangement of facts, the ordering of them in a certain way, so that I see facts in a kind of unfolding pattern that makes sense of the whole. I see the arrangement of the pieces of my life in some kind of meaningful array. Wisdom, then, seems related to the idea of how I see myself. Do I take myself too seriously or not seriously enough? What frame of reference do I use for making big decisions in my life? And while this morning I'm not talking directly about making big decisions, that's more for next week, nevertheless, it comes to play as we seek wisdom for the large and grand things in our lives. I've always made big decisions poorly, in my estimation, whether it was where to go to graduate school, where to move after graduate school, when to marry, and whether to move to Texas. Big decisions have always been very difficult for me. And so, as much for myself as well as for you, I want us to think about the life of Joseph from the perspective of how we see there a proper biblical frame for wisdom. A frame to put around the portrait of our lives, a portrait which I want to suggest to you has two major types of brushstrokes in it. The first brushstroke is that God is absolutely in control of my life. And the second brushstroke is that I make choices that count. Now, clearly, I am jumping into a cauldron that has been boiling for a long time. The relationship of God's sovereignty on the one hand to man's responsibility is a hot issue, probably because we seek so hard to bring the two of them into some logical composition that makes sense to our rational minds, the kind of explanations we like, where we see things fit together. But if the cauldron is boiling, I would suggest to you it's a hot soup we need to drink for our nourishment. The right understanding of God's sovereignty is needed to undergird responsible human action. And precisely today, when in so many ways we see things that seem so totally out of control, it's precisely now that we need to affirm the great underground current that God is inutterably, absolutely, irrevocably in control of this planet and of your life. But we also need to affirm the significance of the choices you will make this afternoon and tomorrow morning, and to affirm the tremendous difference that the right choice makes. So see the difference and the problem of misplaced emphasis. If you put all the weight on the side of human choice to the exclusion of God's sovereignty, and this is obviously what most of the people do most of the time today, if you do that, then you are typical, I should say, of what we could call post-Enlightenment man. That is, human beings who have lived since the latter part of the 18th century have always thought that the beginning and end of all of human life is where I sit, my perception of things. Post-Enlightenment man, or industrial man, or microchip man, the man who's the product of the information age, will always see that he makes decisions, and if God fits somewhere into my decision-making scheme, well, good, I'll let him in, maybe. You see this most obviously in public forums, where God is brought in at the end of a politician's speech to pronounce the benediction. You can always tell when a politician is coming to the end of his speech, or her speech, because he or she will say something about God. If that's one misplaced emphasis, then the opposite misplaced emphasis is equally dangerous. That is all the emphasis on God's sovereignty. If God is in control, then my choices have no meaning, such a person would say. That usually takes two forms. One is a kind of passive, que sera, sera. God is in heaven and all is right with the world. The other form is more sinister. It's fatalism. It doesn't matter what we do. After all, no matter what we as human beings do, all we're doing in the end is rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic. In either case, you see a kind of cosmic cop-out. We try and avoid difficult decisions. Sometimes Christians do this more than other people. Waiting on the Lord becomes an excuse for inaction. And the Lord led me to do thus and so is a cover for possibly irresponsible actions. By the way, don't use that phrase, the Lord led me. It's not a biblical phrase. It's not in the Bible. Because what the Bible teaches about God's leading and about knowing wisdom is a little bit more intricate than God led me. After all, if you say that, how could anyone question you? Instead, we need to see the wholeness and the power of the biblical way. Men and women make truly significant decisions under the sovereignty of God. And we need to learn not to speculate so much about the relationship between God's sovereignty and my choice, but to boldly embrace both and not to separate what God has joined together. In other words, to believe that God's sovereign will, that which the Apostle Paul calls in Romans 12 his good and acceptable and mature will, is realized in the choices that I make before God and on the basis of his word. Now, I want you to see how this is magnificently illustrated in the life of Joseph. Joseph made hard, firm choices which literally affected the destiny of nations and certainly affected those most close to him, his own family. And yet he did so self-consciously under God's sovereignty. In other words, in Joseph's own life, he held together the tension between God's sovereign will and his own choices. There were tremendous swings in Joseph's life. The 11th of Jacob's sons, he was the firstborn to Jacob and Jacob's true love, Rachel. He was the apple of his father's eye, younger than his half-brothers. There's a hint in the text, if you read it through, that he was a bit spoiled. He clearly was the object of his brothers' jealous fury. At their hands, he was thrown into a dry well, then sold to traders in Egypt. Bought by Potiphar, captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard, He was quickly trusted and given responsibility for managing all of Potiphar's affairs. And yet he was thrown in prison when Potiphar's wife, unsuccessful in seducing Joseph, lied to her husband about him. And after 2 years in jail, Pharaoh learns of Joseph that he may help him interpret some troubling dreams which he has been having. And because of Pharaoh's favor, Joseph is then made chief of staff in the most powerful nation on earth, second only to Pharaoh in terms of power in Egypt. Two great gifts dominated Joseph's life. One was an ability to interpret dreams. In other words, an extraordinary insight into things. And the second great gift was unusual administrative and managerial capabilities. But the remarkable thing about Joseph is that he saw these gifts as sovereignly given to him by God for larger purposes than just Joseph. And that affected the way he used them. So that in the midst of the most pagan land in all the world at that time, Egypt, where planets and stars and pharaohs were worshipped as gods, Joseph simply states to the pharaoh, the one who thought himself as a god, that God, the true God, would give him the interpretation to his dream that he needed. And so Joseph saw his life and its swings, not as random fluctuations, not as simply the product of his own choices or the choices of others. But he saw his life in terms of changes under God's sovereignty and for God's purposes. And so Joseph could say of his brother's treachery to him, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." In other words, he's saying, don't call God out even when the worst happens, for God can take the worst and he transforms it into the best for his overall purposes. You see, Joseph's affirmation of God's sovereignty allowed him to see the bigger picture of what God was doing to affect his purposes through him and through his choices. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. You see, Joseph put himself into the context of what God was doing in history. And what God was doing at that moment was preserving a people, his people Israel, so that they would not starve to death in the midst of this worldwide famine. And in order to preserve them, he led Joseph to Egypt, gave him the position of authority there, led the people of Israel down to Egypt where they could eat food and not starve, so that ultimately God's purposes for his people, that out of them would come the Messiah, could be realized. It's a very emotional scene when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers, but it's also quite telling about the way Joseph viewed himself. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close to me." When they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one who sold you into Egypt, the one who you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God." You see how strongly Joseph puts that? Even though it was the choice, the wicked choice, the mean and jealous choice of his brothers, the dominating thought in Joseph's mind was that overarching all of their choices was the sovereign choice of a sovereign God. And convinced of God's control and sovereignty, sure and certain that his overriding purposes would be accomplished, Joseph refused to despair at the bottom of a well. or in the midst of a dirty old Egyptian prison, or when he was unjustly accused or unfairly treated. Instead, what Joseph did was he made choices. And he made them knowing that God was working out a grander purpose in his life, even when he, Joseph, was handed the wrong end of the snake. And he made choices that we should characterize in three ways. They were responsible choices, they were courageous choices, and they were humble choices. Just a minute on each. Responsible choices. I would suggest to you that a responsible choice is to do the unremarkable thing, faithfully, simply because it's the right thing to do. You see this simply in Joseph's moral choices and the use of his administrative gifts. He chooses rightly in the face of Potiphar's wife's seductions. He chooses rightly to retaliate against the vindictiveness of his brothers. He makes responsible, careful decisions about the management of Potiphar's affairs. He's put into prison, but his demeanor there warrants the chief jailers placing him in charge of everything in the prison. And then he manages the agriculture and economy of Egypt for 14 years of wild economic fluctuations in such a judicious way that the world is kept from a devastating famine. God's people, the Hebrews, are preserved so that God's ultimate purpose for them can be realized. Responsible choices. When Barbara and I bought our first little townhouse after getting married, I had buyer's remorse before I had finished the N on Joseph Ryan in the contract. And our realtor, who was obviously used to my type, shored up my confidence by saying, "It's the responsible thing to do, Skip." Well, I don't know whether the purchase of that particular townhouse was responsible, but I do know that many of us are not even doing the minimum. We're not even doing the unremarkable things faithfully and thereby making responsible choices. The choice to leave one's spouse for any other reason save what the Bible provides, namely physical harm to you, desertion, or adultery, the choice to leave one's spouse under any other conditions is always irresponsible. The choice, kids, to drink and to get drunk and to come to local football games drunk is irresponsible. The choice to give 10% of my income to God's kingdom is a responsible choice. And the choice on a football Sunday when the Cowboys play at noon, but you choose to be in church anyway, is the responsible choice. An unremarkable thing, but done faithfully, simply because it's the right thing to do. Well, if responsible choices are to do the unremarkable thing faithfully because it is right, then I would propose to you that courageous choices are those remarkable things that I do riskily, that is, with great risk, for a compelling reason. You see this in Joseph's life, in his ability to interpret dreams with his brothers, with his fellow prisoners, and with Pharaoh. Joseph boldly tells it like it is. He doesn't shrink from the harder truths that his dreams reveal. It's not easy to tell your 10 older brothers that they're going to bow down to you, or to tell a baker that he's going to die in 3 days, or to tell Pharaoh that there's going to be 7 years of famine in his land. But Joseph courageously seizes the day and offers solutions without fully knowing how God in his sovereignty will act. Many of us if we're honest, have shrunk from courageous choices. Choices like this: now that I've made it in my life, how shall I invest my time, my talents, my treasure? Or, now that I haven't made it in my life, or even if I have, what are the values that should grow out of my life and be evidenced? What is the overarching vision I have for the use of my life in this world? A man that many of us know well has been enormously successful in his business. At the age of 44, he had everything that he wanted, and he hired a world-renowned strategic planner to help him not plan his business, but this time to plan the rest of his life. This man is a Christian. The planner wasn't. But the planner asked the Christian to make a courageous choice. He asked him this question: what is in the box? Before you can plan, he said, you have to know what is in the center. What is the mainspring of your life? Now, here's how this Christian businessman tells it. Literally, of course, he says, there was no box. Figuratively, I had spread out on a table before him a jumble of dreams and desires, lists of perceived strengths and weaknesses, professions of faith, projects begun and half begun, things to do and things to abandon. I was like a cacophony of noisy themes and trills of the sort one hears when symphony orchestra musicians are warming up for public performance and seeking their pitch. The strategic planner announced that we could not put together a sane and honest plan for my life until I identified the mainspring. Was it, he demanded, money? Or was it something else? He said to me, I've been listening to you for a couple of hours, and I'm going to ask you, what's in the box? For you, it's either money or Jesus Christ. If you can tell me which it is, I can tell you the strategic planning implications of that choice. If you can't tell me, you are going to oscillate back and forth between those two values and be confused. No one had ever put such a significant question to me so directly. And after a few minutes, which seemed like hours, I said, well, if it has to be one or the other, I'll put Jesus Christ in the box. Now, this man goes on to explain that that does not mean his lifestyle radically changed, that he ran off to Bunga Bunga Land to be a missionary. But it did mean his life dramatically changed. You see, courageous choices are those remarkable choices that are done with risk for a compelling reason. And then finally, and quite briefly, humble choices are also those that Joseph made. Joseph does not eat humble pie. No false humility here. In fact, if you read through his account, he comes off rather arrogant at times. And yet, nevertheless, before God, Joseph was humble. He can say to Pharaoh, in the perfect moment to take credit, it's not me who can interpret your dream. I do it because of God's gift. And at the pinnacle of his personal power and influence, Joseph assures his brothers that no harm will come to them because, as he says, I am not in God's place. Irresponsible, courageous, and humble choices, Joseph did not know the end from the beginning. He didn't know how it was going to turn out, but he knew how he was to act. And he knew, and hear this, that in and through his choices, God's sovereign purpose would be worked out. Now, I want to propose to you that apart from the actual existence of a sovereign God, that's the most arrogant thing a person could ever say. that through my choices, the will of God is going to work out. And yet under the sovereignty of God, self-consciously placing myself under the lordship of Christ. That's the most significant thing that perhaps a person can say. You see, there's a crucible to wisdom, a tension, isn't there? It's living with both truths and not allowing them to separate. God is sovereign, and I am utterly significant in my choices. It's like the tension of a watermelon seed in your thumb and forefinger. You squeeze and squeeze, and out it comes. Living self-consciously under God's sovereignty and at the same time making responsible, courageous, humble choices is the way to the course of wisdom. Because it saves you from falling off the horse on one side or the other. One side, all there is my choice. That's it. The other side, fatalism. Doesn't matter what I do. Remember Jacob, Joseph's father, back in Israel, while the brothers go down to Egypt? All alone, he had too much time to himself. In fact, he had not enough decisions to make, you might say, and he slid over into fatalism. When Jacob's sons returned from their first trip to Egypt, where they had left their brother Simeon with Joseph, Jacob despairs because he thinks that Joseph and Simeon are now dead. And so he says, Joseph is no more, Simeon is no more, everything is against me. But at that very moment, Joseph was the chief of staff of Egypt, and Simeon was in the safest place he could be on earth. And Jacob didn't know it, because all he was seeing was a kind of fatalistic view of life. Many of us as Christians say, everything is against me. I'll just go and eat worms. But wisdom is seeing that as I live under the sovereignty of God, and I live out my choices that are significant, and as I live them out in light of His kingdom, I will be walking in the way of wisdom. So whether it's buying a house, or marrying a spouse, or taking a job, my choice is significant. But it counts when I do it under the lordship of Christ. That is, by self-consciously saying, Lord, what honors you? And what extends your kingdom? I want to make that choice. Proverbs 9 says that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear means regard for who the Lord is. Regard for Him as King. He is King. Live under His kingship, and then go and make decisions boldly. Wisdom is being responsible and courageous about the things I can change, and humble about the things I can't. And it's recognizing that both things, the things I can change and the things I can't, are the means of God's will being accomplished. A wise person is the calm person, because he or she knows that God is going to work it out, not necessarily for the good of my benefit, but for the benefit of His good purposes. The wise person is the realistic person, the uncomplicated person, who simply says, Pharaoh, God will tell you what your dream means, because God is wiser than men. The realistic person is a person who simply recognizes that God is wise and I am not. And so the wise person is happy to let God be God and not to try and figure Him out or to make Him fit my expectations of just exactly how He ought to work it out. The wise person is a worshiping person who isn't bashful to say, oh, the depths of the riches of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments. How unfathomable are his ways. Who has known the mind of the Lord? Who has been his counselor? Who has ever given to God that God should repay him? For from him and through him and to him are all things. To him be the glory forever. Amen.